Welcome to this session. The title of the session needs a little bit of explanation. I happen to have a name which is kind of hard to live with in the English-speaking world. It doesn't build confidence to go around with Lie as your last name. In my native Norwegian, it's not Lie, it's Li. But that turns me into Chinese often, so it's a little hard to navigate in this landscape. But I'm going to try to tell you the truth today, as far as I know it. CSS3 is evolving. There is no definite answer yet. And one of my conclusions is that actually you can tell us the answer. As users, as authors, as people who are enthusiastic about new ways of describing web documents, you can actually provide us with the solution to some of these. What are the things that we should focus on? What are the things browsers should implement? What should the CSS working group work on? What would you like to write? What kind of code do you want to see? So we're going to go through some of the things in the CSS world, some of the things that are being worked on right now. My focus will be on things that stuff that can be used in implementations today. All the things that I will be demonstrating here today will be shown in a browser, and it will be things that you can download yourself. Not all browsers support this interoperably all over the place, but all of it is implemented somewhere, and it's ready to be played with, at least. And some of the things are further ahead than that as well. We'll comment on this as we go along. I hope there will also be time for questions towards the end. First, though, I'd like to go back a little bit in time and look at where CSS came from. This is a timeline where we started. In 1994, I was at CERN working with Tim Berners-Lee. I'm going to show you some pictures from that era next. But just here, the timeline here, I proposed CSS under a slightly different name, Cascading HTML Style Sheets, in 1994. We dropped the HTML quite quickly because we wanted CSS to apply to not just HTML documents, but also XML documents and other structured markup languages. And then we had nice progress. In 1996, we had the CSS1 recommendation come out. 2 years later, we had the CSS2 recommendation come out. And we were thinking maybe, you know, year 2000, that'd be a fantastic celebration to have CSS3 come out. Now, it didn't quite turn out that way. We're now in 2012, are we? And we don't have CSS3 yet. It's not done yet. And part of the reason for that is around the year 2000, CSS started working. You could actually use CSS in browsers. That meant it got a whole wider audience suddenly. A lot of people came to it and saw, wow, we can do some cool stuff here, but also I'd like to do this, and this, and this, and this, and this. So we had all these requests coming, and the only way to deal with that was really to split the specification up into several parts. Whereas CSS1 and CSS2 were single documents, CSS3 was soon split up into modules, which is a great way of telling people if they come with some ideas, I'd like to have this functionality implemented, then you can say, yeah, we do it in, here's your module. Do a module on it. It's not necessarily the best way to have progress be made quicker. If you have all these specifications in parallel, they don't always move as quickly as they could if we all focus was on one of those modules. I think at this stage there are about 50 modules in the W3C repository. Not all of them are being worked on actively. Here's some of them, the top list. Here's the kind of bottom end of the list. Some of them are experimental. Some will die a slow death in the roadside. But some of them will become an important part of the web of tomorrow. So CERN, this is where the web was invented. It's an incredible place. It's a physics laboratory. It wasn't set up to design the web. It was set up to detect very small particles. This is a picture from the detector, which is under the ground, about 170 meters underground outside of Geneva, at the border between Switzerland and France. It's a circle, and it crosses the border 6 times. So the geometry there isn't as straight as we may want it to be. But it's much more interesting what's below the ground. And you can see the scale of things. This is a man here standing. These detectors are enormous. This is the world's biggest machine. And it's set up to detect the world's smallest, or at least the smallest that we know or can think of for the moment, particles. And this is the man, Tim Berners-Lee, who invented the web around 1990. He came up with some very crucial concepts that we still build on, the concept of URLs, the HTTP protocol, and the HTML language. And I wasn't there when he did HTML, but I remember seeing HTML source code for the first time, and I was struck. Can it be this simple? Wow! You know, you can do hypertext, internet hypertext, with a simple language like HTML. So I came running to CERN and joined the project very early. This was at a time when there was, you know, basically just an office and a couple of computers. And we set up one of the computers in the hallway outside our office. So this was the first public web terminal. You can see that, you know, CERN is really about pipelines much more than anything else. And here's the board next to the computer. And I think we can conclude at this stage that it wasn't the marketing, it wasn't the slogan, you click, we do the rest, that made the web into a fantastic success. It was something else. So here's the pipelines again. And these pipes were found outside the office where Tim and the rest of us had to walk every day. And my hypothesis is that when he designed HTML, he saw these things subconsciously in the background. You know HTML? Yeah? You know H1, H2, H3? And then there's the 4, 5, 6 that nobody uses. Then there's a couple other ones. All right. So HTML is a fantastic little language. It's got a simple structure. It's got a shallow but universal semantics. And it doesn't say anything about presentation. It's independent of screens or speech or anything else. So as people started using this, they said, but we'd like to, you know, set the color. We'd like to set the font size. We'd like to, you know, describe the layout of things. And HTML wasn't the answer. And then the image tag came along. Netscape, Mark Andreessen, invented the image tag one night. And then they suddenly had a way to get typography and colors and fonts. They simply made pictures of the text. They simply took the image tag and put a picture of the text they wanted to convey and published it that way. So we lost the text suddenly. And there was a path down where the web could have turned into the world's biggest fax machine, where we would have traded images of text, just like fax machines do, instead of sending text over as text. And some of us saw this danger and said, wait, we can't let this happen. We need to give the designers the tools they request. They'd like to do fonts and stuff, and we think fonts are cool too. And we should allow them to do so without removing the textual content of the web. We should continue using HTML. We don't want to turn HTML into a page description language, but we should give them a tool in addition to that. And that's how CSS came along. Without CSS and without images, these were the kind of web pages that people had been publishing around 1993 or so. This is Mosaic. Any Mosaic users in the audience? Still, quite a few. That's great. Very good. You've been with us for a long time. Also, I think aesthetics, even though CSS was sort of set out to save the semantic part of the web, aesthetics should never be discounted. In scientific environments, aesthetics isn't really what people are thinking about first and foremost, but it's really what talks to the human brain. Our visual system is much more advanced than anything else, really. And this is the picture from CERN as well. This is above the ground. This is one of the most beautiful places on the planet. You can see Mont Blanc in the background here. You can see the French vineyards in the front. It's really stellar. If you turn the camera, you have the Jura Mountains. These cows are happily grazing in the fields. They don't know what's what's going on underneath there. But my point is that this is really, for most people, this is more beautiful than the picture of the machine that I showed you in the beginning here. So we need to take aesthetics with us as we develop the web standards, the web languages of choice. So therefore, CSS came along. CSS is like HTML, very simple language. Just like you can say, you know, here's a headline in HTML. You can, whoops, I have a little error here. You spot the error, I'm sure. You can set the font size and the color and some simple layout options for the presentation of this element. And as years moved on, CSS developed. We added more things. You can now take, this is one of the first examples of where we saw designers really use CSS seriously, where you could take one of those boring-looking documents and add a style sheet to them, and you suddenly have a very different presentation. The CSS Zen Garden was an eye-opener for designers, for authors. Now, admittedly, there's a lot of images being used here as well. Some of the background image is used extensively to create these pages, but the text is there behind, and it can be indexed by search engines and such. So we kind of stopped HTML from becoming that image-only environment. So moving forward, just to recount, what can CSS do? You can do some very simple things. I'm sure quite a few of you, all of you, have done these things, setting font styles. You can set the font family, you can set the background, you can set the border. You know, in 1997, this was pretty cool stuff. Being able to set the background and setting the border around elements, this was great. Today it looks kind of, I don't know. Text shadow was one of the more advanced things that was in CSS2, where you could actually create a shadow without using Photoshop. You could, you just do this, you set very simple code. You have the code up here. It's a one-liner to create some fairly interesting patterns there. And the good thing about this compared to images is not only is it much more compact, but it's also much easier to use if you fix a typo in your text. The shadow will adapt automatically. If you translate your web page into another language, this will automatically work. You don't have to go back to your Photoshop editor to change things. So as such, CSS is a text-centric format. It's often operating on text and trying to make sure that the text can be presented in a beautiful and functional manner. Now we move to CSS3. Border radius is one of the more solid things in the CSS3 specification. The proposal to have rounded borders came up very early, at least. Very early in the CSS1 development, and I remember being very much against the idea of putting it into CSS1. I thought, you know, this is so passé. Whoever wants rounded borders, it's so 70s. I mean, we've moved on from there, haven't we? Well, it turned out we hadn't. This has been requested by so many people, so it was one of the first things that got into CSS3 and was implemented by all the browsers. And it's actually pretty cool. I've turned around on this. You can, by, again, setting just one line of code, you can make some interesting visual effects. Here we're setting the border radius for horizontal and vertical separately so that you get a very different expression from the starting point. And by adding more values here, you can set different rounding in different corners. So you can, you know, create a very different visual expression just by changing one line of code. Of course, this is just fluff. This is just visual fluff. There's no meaning to this. It's only presentational. But I think we shouldn't disregard it still. The human brain, again, that's what it likes. It likes the visual fluff, so we should give it to it. Box shadow, also very interesting, builds on the same idea as text shadow, where you can, in one line of code, add a fluffy little thing. And then, you know, it doesn't have to be kind of a 3D shadow, it can be kind of a spray paint-like pattern. This is what we discover when we add things, that we can do things we'd never thought about. Here's another example. this little keyword here, inset. You see the difference? See what happens when you add that little inset keyword? Then suddenly the border jumps inside, and you get a very different visual presentation. Here's kind of a spray paint-like pattern, and now you're in the 3D soft world. Very cool, I think. I'm not a designer, but I hope many of you are, and that you will be using these things to good effect. Because there's plenty of websites out there that could benefit from this. This is a menu that you find on every Apple page. It's actually changed a bit since I took this screenshot, but I think the structure behind it is the same. It's quite nice. Somebody, you know, sat down here and decided to have the font with some outline underneath, the roundedness of the search field, the roundedness in the edges. There's a little bit of shadow here, and then there's a gradient across the gray. The only problem with it is that it's sent, it comes across as an image. Apple, I haven't checked the latest sources. Apple may have changed this, but I don't think they have. I think there's still images on their pages. And the good news is that it doesn't have to be that way. You can actually recreate that menu entirely in CSS 3 now. This is the example where, you know, this is, there's not a single image, except for the Opera logo in the corner, there's not a single image on this page. You can do all of it in CSS 3. I've accentuated some of the functionality here, where you see we've added the text, the little outline here with text shadow. We've done the roundedness with the border radius. We set the shadows with box shadows and done the same thing over here. So many of the effects that designers have been used to doing in Photoshop can now be done better in CSS 3. Of course, the problem, and you know, Apple is well aware of this. I think the reason why they haven't switched yet is that the browsers, the older browsers, don't support this. That's certainly something you need to think about as you create sites and put them into production, whether this is ready for production yet. And I think with the border radius, for example, I think it is. The worst thing that can happen there is that you don't see the rounded edge, which isn't a catastrophe, really. So that can be used for real. Some of the other things we're going to go into may not be ready yet, but it's certainly ready to play with. Web fonts is one of the things that are ready. Technically, this is also part of CSS 2. Web fonts is about pointing to font files on the web so that you can add more variety, visual variety in your designs. What happened in the 1995 was that Microsoft came along and said, we'd like to contribute to the web. We'd like to release all these fonts that we have. And they had spent a whole lot of money developing these fonts. And they said, we'd like to release them for free to anyone to use on any operating system. It was a fantastic donation to the web. It made it possible to install these on Linux and Mac and Windows, of course. And they work great. They're high-quality fonts. They have reasonable coverage. The big problem with them these days, I think, is that we're a little sick and tired of them. I would guess that more than 50% of what people read on screens still is using these fonts here. Maybe the number is much higher even. So that limits us. If we only have 10 fonts in web pages, that limits us significantly. And before we have web fonts, again, people could make images, but that's not the right solution either. So the right solution is to use web fonts, and that's very, very easy these days. You can now add two lines of code. First, you import a style sheet from somewhere, and this line is a little longer than my screen, but it's basically giving a URL that points to a style sheet. And in that style sheet, it has all the declarations of the font names and where these fonts can be found. There are thousands of free fonts available. I think I counted 6,000 free fonts on one site. I'll be showing some of the fonts made by Dieter Steffmann, who's a German type designer. So this is a font we're looking at here, Angel, and I'm using Opera to show this. So this is in the browser for real. And this is interoperably implemented in all browsers now, so this can be used in your designs. Again, the worst things that can happen if people don't have a web font capable browser, like IE6, for example, is that they don't see this beautiful Angel font. But that's not too bad. And, you know, that gives them a reason to upgrade as well. So Steffmann is great. He has a wide range of designs. I wouldn't recommend using this one, broadcast titling, maybe for your CV or your newspaper articles. It's a bit tiresome to read, but you know, for a birthday invitation or something special, then it's suitable certainly. Also, web fonts will be important for languages that don't have the support of major operating systems. In Norway, we have three languages, actually. Two that are based on the normal Latin set, and one Sami, which has all these extra characters. And they've struggled hard to get support for those characters in Windows. And if you go further out, further away from the Latin languages, you have even more problems. So seeing this message just before New Year's was great to me. I really enjoyed reading this message where the Wikipedia project say that they now have deployed web fonts for 40 wikis in 11 Indic languages. These are more languages than I ever knew existed in India. But they use them to great effect. And I'm going to show you some screenshots, what it looks like. This is Hindi, and this is a screenshot that's been taken in a split of a second before all the web fonts have been downloaded, so you can see the rectangles here. They're characters that are waiting to find its font. And in the next second, those fonts have come down. So there's a little shift as the page fills out with the right fonts. But typically, fonts are very compact. A font for a Latin-based language, like English, is typically the same size as a photograph, like 50K. Of course, it varies depending on the design and how many characters there are, but it's quite small compared to all the data we have on the web today. For other languages, Eastern languages, CJK, Chinese, Japanese, Korean, it's bigger because they have many more characters. So there you need to do subsetting and some other tricks. But that's doable, and web fonts can handle that as well. So whether you want to use web fonts to do cool birthday invitations or whether you want to educate the world about science, Wikipedia-like stuff, web fonts are a usable tool these days. And it can be used, I think, in production now. CSS3 transitions, that's another exciting area. Again, with a few lines of code, you can do some incredible things. This is an image. It's an SVG image. And what I say in the two lines of code here is that I want to have a transition. That is, I want to, when the mouse hovers over the image, I want there to be a transformation. And the transformation should be to rotate the image minus 360 degrees. So basically one turning of the coat of arms here. This is the Norwegian coat of arms. There's actually a law in Norway that says that the coat of arms has to come at the top of the page, which is the case here. But I don't think the law would allow me to do this kind of flip-flopping of the... So maybe I'm in trouble, but I'm safe here in Texas, right? All right. Transitions are very cool. Mostly they're used for small stuff, like when you hover over a link or something, you have a little shift in color, maybe a little moving of the thing. Few people have started using it for this animation-like things. There's also CSS animations, which can be used for that. I think we'll be seeing a lot more of this in the time to come. You can do animations without being a programmer. This is all declarative in the spirit of CSS. CSS is not a programming language. It's very much a simple declarative language, which can be used to do a lot of things easily. It can't be used for everything. There's a limit to it, but it tries to do things well when it does it. Here's a little side note on testing. Testing is very important as we proceed with these things. It's often the case, and I'm sure those of you who are developing pages have seen this, when you try to use new functionality or even trusted old functionality, it sometimes appears differently in different browsers. And that's certainly the case for these new features, which are very visual. And here, in the screenshot here, you can see some examples. This is a historical screenshot. I think this has improved much now for the border radius things, but it shows the kind of things that can happen when you are on the cutting edge. And it's then very important that you report this, that you tell somebody. The best you can do is to write a test case to show what you think it should be like and compare that to what it is right now. And the CSS working group has thousands of test cases that have been submitted by various people. Some are very active in this. There's a strong community to this, and some are done by vendors. Microsoft have been, again, very generous with their test cases. That hasn't always been the case, though. We had a big fight with Microsoft when they said they would do IE7. Then we'd had IE6 for, I think, 5 years without there being another major release. And Bill Gates blogged about how Microsoft was all for standards and interoperability. I got a little emotional at that point and said, hey, you know, if you want to do standards, you should really look at how you do CSS. So some of us got together and said, you know, we're going to write a web page. One web page, and we challenge you to get it right when IE7 ships. And this was called the ACID 2 challenge, the ACID 2 page. And this is what the ACID 2 page looks like when it's rendered correctly. And every pixel, every thing, every element on this page is a test. And if you don't get the standards right, one of these pixels will be off, and you will easily see that it doesn't support the standards. So this became a challenge not just to Microsoft, but to all the browsers, because, hey, there are bugs all over the place, and none of the browsers do it perfectly. So what the ACID 2 tried to do was try to see, these are the features we'd like browsers to support, and if everyone supports them in the same way, then we can move forward. Then we can save developers from all these interoperability problems in the future. So we launched ACID 2, and this is what it looked like in IE6. And we chose that red. We probably could have designed it so that not all of it became very red like that. We could have chosen a different color for one. But it's traditional to use red when something's wrong in tests, so I think it's okay. I'm not sure, you know, you can see that it's kind of a face, right? And it's got two eyes and a mouth, and then there's something. I'm not sure what this thing there is. And then IE7 came along, and this is what it looked like in IE7, and it's still kind of a face. You see the two eyes there, right? And the dribble has turned into something something else. I don't know what that is. But then the magic thing happened when IE8 shipped. This is what it looked like. Suddenly they had fixed it. And the only reason I can think of, you know, I'm not part of their internal meetings, but I know that a lot of people challenged them on this. A lot of people stood up in conferences like this, asked questions to Microsoft developers, when are you going to support ACID 2? ACID 2 became kind of a landmark. If you didn't support ACID 2, then you weren't in the game anymore. And Microsoft wanted to be in the game. So I think at some point they just said, darn it, we're just going to have to do it. We'd rather do this, this, and this, but hey, you know, ACID 2 is there, we had to do it. So this is really the story of how one web page changed a giant corporation, Microsoft's plans for the road ahead, and they just had to do it. And I think there's a lot of opportunities for activism like that on the web, where somebody vocal puts out something, gets the support of the community, and then can force browser makers, including Opera, which I'm responsible for to some extent, to do the right thing. I think we need those kind of reminders from the community. Okay, moving on. Multi-column layout. This is another CSS3 specification. You all have read books. You know how books typically lay out their content in multiple columns. This is an example here I just put together where you can see that it's not a table. A lot of times people have been simulating multi-column layout with tables on the web before they had true multi-column features. This is what I'm doing here. This is not what I'm doing here. I'm actually using multi-column. So you can see that when I select text, moving from one to the other, there's a logical following here. So it's actually just a bunch of first an image, then a bunch of P elements, all living inside a div which has some settings on it. And those settings are very simple. Here, I can set on this div with class multicol, I can set columns to be two, for example. Very easy. Then I declare, I want two columns in this element. So the content of that element will be flowed into two columns. Another alternative, perhaps a better solution, is to not set the number of columns, but to set the optimal width of the columns. By setting it to 20 m's, so basically 20 characters, the number of columns can vary depending on the width of your device. So if you have a very wide screen, maybe you end up with three or four columns, whereas if you're on the phone, you might just have one column. So this is an example where CSS is adaptable by design, where you can just set one value, which is the optimal reading width, and then that value will scale automatically, so that as an author, you don't have to deal with it. You don't have to write specific code for wide screens or small screens. You can do that, too, with media queries, but you don't have to do it. This is very much more simpler. It's just one declaration. And this is being used in practice. Wikipedia is using it for their references. Here's a screenshot from the page on South by Southwest, where you can see that the references, 34 of them, line up in two columns, and this is done using multicol. Multicol is ready for use, I think. IE9 does not support it, but IE10 will. They've shown this in the preview. They have a good implementation on it. I think the fact that IE doesn't support it yet has held it back, but I hope we can move forward on that very quickly. As you start playing with this, you will soon realize that it doesn't always work ideally on the screen. For example, if I increase the font size on in my browser on this Wikipedia page, I see that not all of the references fit on one page anymore. So I start with the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 in the first column, and it goes to 13, and then 14, 15, etc. are below the fold. And then it picks up again on 19, 20. So if I wanted to read all these in order, I would have to scroll down and up again, which is not ideal. It doesn't matter so much for references because you never sit down and read those. This here, it's mostly about saving space, which is another feature of multi-column layout. But if you were to present, for example, a novel, and you were on a scrolling device and you just said two columns, then you would have to read one column all the way, and then you have to scroll back up again, which is not ideal. So one motivation for doing multi-column layout is paper. On paper, there's a natural limit to how far the column can go down. It's limited by the page size. Here's a picture of a very beautiful book from about 500 years back. This is Gutenberg's Bible, which was the first major work that he printed after inventing the printing press. And he made some truly stunning presentations. And you see, Gutenberg used multicol too. So this is certainly something we'd like to do in CSS3. I think we shall try to replicate. We can't do everything. We can't do all of this yet, but certainly the multicall is now within reach. And a few years back, I wrote a book on CSS, along with Bert Boss, who's worked on many of the early specifications, and he's still the style sheet contact within W3C. We wrote a book about CSS, and we wanted to use CSS to see if it was possible to do a print publication with HTML and CSS. Because often in the production lines, you have the web guys doing HTML, CSS, and JavaScript, you know, and then in the corner you have some people working on InDesign if they want some printed versions of the same material. That's the way book content has been produced, and I don't think it has to be that way. I think we can use the same source files, the same HTML and the same CSS for print and for screen use. And when we did this a few years back, the only product that could format this book was a product called Prince, which is not a browser. It's a batch processor which converts HTML to PDF. Now there's a couple more products, I think. So now I think it's very possible to make professional-looking print publications using HTML and CSS. So we weren't sure we would succeed at that point, but as you can see, the book is here. We were able to do it. We had to add a few things along the way. This was kind of a case study to see what was there, what was lacking. And here's the screenshot that shows some of the things that we had to add to CSS in order to do printed publications. The most basic thing is probably the page number, which is down in the corner here. That's quite easy to do. We had counters in CSS, so it was easy to extend it to be page counters. Then there's the multi-column layout, which I've talked about. That's certainly very useful, very, very necessary when you do printed publications. Footnotes, quite hard. We treat them like floats here. You float them to the footnote area, which is at the bottom. And then you have to number them and such, where we use counters. And that's quite doable. Along the edges, you have these marks, the cross marks and cut marks, where printers, this is where they cut the paper when they do the printing. This is kind of a very easy, very simple declaration in CSS. But it's very useful when you send something to the printer. They actually want that kind of stuff. The hardest part on this page is probably the table of contents, where we generate, we have the chapters, the list of chapters here. Then you have the leaders, these dots. The length of the leader is unknown when you do the when you write the HTML and CSS code. And also the page numbers here are unknown because you don't know what the formatting will look like. You don't know what will end up on page 1 and page 2 and page 3. That depends on so many other factors like font size and the size of images and such. So that you can't hard code these things. These have to be generated automatically. We'll look at the code for that a bit later. This page shows another very important feature, to be able to float figures to the top and bottom of pages, not only left and right, which we have in CSS1, but also top and bottom of pages. So here's the table of contents. Let's spend a little bit of time on looking at this. So here's the basic output that you want to have. You want to have the chapter title, then you want to have leaders, and then you want to have a page number. And as I said, this page number, you can't hard code it. You had to generate it automatically. And here's the code for doing that. This is probably the most hairy code you'll ever see in CSS. I don't think it can get worse than this. So you kind of reach the limit here. You start out with HTML, quite simple, two LI elements, which point to the chapters we want to have in the table of contents. So there's chapter 1 here and chapter 2 here. And then we want to style this UL so that they add a leader, and that comes here. We use the content property. We style the A element. We say after the A element, there should be some content, and that content should consist of leaders. And this is a new construct in CSS3 where you can add as many characters as you want of this kind, as many as there's room for on the line. So that fills it up with dots. And then at the very end, there's a target counter. And here we have nested parentheses. Can you follow me on this? Okay. So we're looking for the attribute, the href attribute. We have the href attribute here. So that has a URL as a argument. So we're looking at this URL here, where it points to. At the point where it points to, we pick up the value of a counter, and we use the page counter. I mentioned that earlier. That's one that automatically increases for every page. So here, what this thing here returns is the page number on the end of the link. And that's exactly what you want to have in the table of contents. Don't worry if you didn't follow me on all of this. This just shows it's possible. And it's, you know, you can sit down and parse this in a couple more minutes, maybe. It doesn't take that long. But this is really the worst it gets in CSS. You won't see much harder code than this. Now, pages, we know they're usable in print. I also think they're usable on the screen. And we've seen some apps lately. You heard of apps? We've seen some apps that have been using this to present content. We also seen on the web that some publications, New York Times in particular, have been struggling very hard to try to create pages inside web. And they've been using a lot of JavaScript, complex JavaScript, to accomplish this, and it kind of works sometimes. It's hard to do in JavaScript because you don't have the basic primitives you need. And this is why I think that we need to think about pages for the web as well, for screen use. I think pages is something, it's one of the fundamental elements of publishing. And we've been playing with this at Opera, and I'd like to give you a presentation of the Opera Reader, as we call it, which is basically a couple of CSS extensions. Can you see this? Okay. Here I'm using the experimental build, which is available for anyone to download, Windows, Mac, Linux, and Android. What we're doing here is taking a web page. Web pages, you know, normally have a scroll bar on the right-hand side. So if there's more content, you get a scroll bar and you can get to the content. We don't do that here. We do like the Romans did 2,000 years ago. They took the scroll, they had documents in scrolls. But one day, one guy found out that if they split those scrolls, they could do other things with them. They could make books, they could bind them, they could put them on shelves, they could create libraries. The Western civilization is basically built on books. And we're doing the same here. We're taking those scrolled documents of the web, and we're saying, I don't want a scroll bar, I want pages instead. So by now dragging this with the mouse, I can get to the rest of the content of this article instead of using a scroll bar. I have it. It's actually even more natural to do this on a tablet. I have exactly the same thing running here, where I just use my finger to go to the next page. This is very simple in CSS. I can show you the code. It's basically a one-liner where we say overflow paged. You see it up here, overflow colon paged. There's a Opera prefix there, which we need when we play with this. But this is something we're working in the working group, and we hope that other browsers will implement this as well. I think, as a side note here, if we're going to compete with the apps, with web languages, we need to provide the things that apps can do. And we've done that for geolocation. You can now get the GPS coordinates from a web page. You can get access to the devices, etc. We need to, as web people, we need to give developers the kind of tools, the kind of options they have in the app world. Otherwise, you know, they'll do more apps and less web pages, and that's not a good thing. So a few more demos here. Here's a newspaper layout. Here's a very traditional newspaper layout where you have a three column. You have three columns. I'm using multicolumns for that. You have an image that's being floated to the corner, and it spans two columns. This is the prototypical newspaper article. And then when the article continues, I move on to the next page. And there I find first an ad, and then the article continues. Ads are important too. We need ads for the web. I think ads, and I'm going to show you what this looks like when I move to a slightly different format. I'm using media queries to give it a different layout when I'm in a portrait mode. And here I get a different ad. I get a full page ad. I think the magazine version of ads, where you do get full page ads, instead of having these blinking things in the corner like we have on the web, I think this is a much more relaxed experience. I think readers can accept much more having those kinds of ads in the articles. So this is basically just a floating image which is sitting there on the page. Now I'm going to go back to the... Going to continue reading the article here. So here I'm... This is all standard HTML. E1.html is the file. I've added a few lines of CSS3, experimental CSS3, to do the paging. And see what happens now when I continue move to the right. I have E1, and then I move to E2.html. So what's going on there is that E1 knows what's the next article in line. HTML has these link elements for that to say what's next and previous. So we can move to the next article. We can go up to the index. We can move in this landscape so that it's it feels more like moving in books, turning pages, instead of just clicking like we've been used to on the web. And some of the content, like book-like content, is much more suitable, I think, for a page presentation than it is for scroll bars. What do you think? You like it? Thank you. Thank you. Okay, so my last demo here, before the questions, I was so inspired by the Alice in Wonderland book that I decided to write a children's book of my own. Do you know what a troll is? Troll is one of the few Norwegian words that has made it into English over the last 20 years or so. In Norway, we have real trolls, not those fake ones you find on the internet. Some of them are nice. Some of them are nasty. We didn't turn the page? Here we are. See that? Did I hear applause? Yeah? Okay. So this is another example of giving designers something they have in the apps world. In the apps world, they have access to the camera on the device. And we have to do the same here. If you want the web languages to win, and I think they will win, I think in the future we will write apps as web apps. But it won't happen unless we have things like this. So this is not CSS, really. This is HTML5. This is Get User Media, an API that has been developed to give people access to the various devices there. All right, very good. I think we're now running out of time. I was going to show you the code to do the page thing, but I think you can find it. The slides are available from my homepage. My final goal before I retire from the CSS working group will be to do the Gutenberg Bible, to do it right the way it is. It's very hard to do. You see the hyphenation marks here are outside the columns, for example, a few things like that. But I think we should have those goals in sight. And I also think that this should be the time frame. This book was done 500 years ago. And that's the time frame we should be thinking of. We shouldn't be thinking of only what developers want over the next 12 months. We should be thinking, can this stuff last for 500 years? I predict it will. I predict that a computer, if you buy a computer 500 years from now, you can read the pages that we create today. In today's HTML and CSS, those pages can be displayed on those computers. Who are with me on that? Are you with me on that? Yeah, I think so. Of course, it's easy to say, it's easy to throw it out, because 500 years from now, I'm not going to be around. But I think it's good to have that number in mind so that we make sure we do good specs that people can use and that can live for a very long time. I think I'll stop there. We have a few minutes left for questions, if there are any. We have some volunteers here with microphones that promise to run around if there are somebody who... There's a question over there. Yeah.
First of all, I'd like to shout out to Opera for pushing standards and features forward on the web for us,
Thank you.
Secondly, I've been using a lot of the CSS preprocessors like Less and Sass and some of the killer features like variables and mix-ins.
Yeah.
Where do you see those going and making that into the spec down the road?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think some of the things maybe we should have put in there from the beginning. We tried to keep CSS very small so that it would the threshold for implementing it would be low. Variables, I think, will work quite easily. It will integrate nicely with the rest of the language. And there is a specification in the CSS working group that will go to last call now. No, first public working draft. Okay, so it will come out very soon. Yes. Okay, so there's many people who'd like to see variables come out, at least, so I think that will give you a lot of it. I don't think we should move very quickly on this. We shouldn't change the language. My fear is that it will soon become a Turing complete programming language, and that I don't want to see. But I think variable makes a lot of sense. So yes, that will happen.
I wonder if you can speak a little bit about the development or progress of grids.
Right. There are many layout proposals being worked on in the working group at the moment. I'm not personally so involved with grids. It's happening. We have not implemented it in Opera. Maybe we will. I have some questions, to be honest, about how to present things. I believe that some of the things that I showed with multi-columns here, I wonder how to do them in grids. I don't think it's possible to do in grids as grids currently stand. So I think there's a discussion that needs to take place between multicol, between grids, between regions, as some other people are pushing. This is the beauty of modularization, right? Everyone gets to have their own modules. And then we need to mesh them out. We need to find what use cases can be solved using what specification. And what the answer will be, what comes out in the end, I don't know. A good sign is what the browsers implement. If all the browsers implement regions, or all of them implement grids, or all of them implement multicol, then that will be something that will be moved forward. As far as grid and implementations, I know IE9 has an implementation, but I believe the specification has changed significantly since then. So if you want to be part of this discussion, the right place to be is on www.style. And I think this is really the time to be giving input on the development on the grid and the other layout proposals.
Hi, thank you for the presentation. This was great. I had a question for you about how you feel about using shivs or shims to try and use JavaScript or other techniques to bring older browsers closer into compatibility with HTML5 and CSS3.
Yeah.
I appreciate your statement that if you're on a really old browser, maybe you're on IE6 or 7, it's okay to not have your rounded corners, but that's also a difficult sell for the client.
Yeah.
So I was just curious in your idea of shims, shivs.
I think it's necessary to do, and I think it's amazing what people are able to do using various hacks of comments and JavaScripts and whole libraries doing these kinds of things. And I think it's necessary to do. At the same time, I'm a little bit worried that people might say that, we have now a JavaScript library or some other technique that will allow us to achieve these effects without doing the native implementations. That's my only worry, really, about it, that we kind of get stuck in that world. It's good enough. Like I said, the paging thing can be done in part by using JavaScript. So some might say, we don't need to do pages in CSS. We can just use JavaScript. And I think that would be wrong. We need to move forward and have support for those fundamental, basic typographic needs that people have. And those had to be natively supported in CSS. Just like in the HTML world with video, we want video to be a first-class citizen. That's why we proposed the video element and want to have native decoding of video content in the browser. There's some first-class citizens that you want to have very good support for, and I think video and pages and multicall stuff, that's top of my list. But I encourage people to use, and if it can help people to put this into production by using some of the techniques to, you know, make sure IE users are happy so that your boss don't come running in, that's great. Just do it. Perfect. Thank you all for coming.